Roth, 6 a.m.
Roth Radio, I'm David Lee Roth. Quoting from page 6, where the only news worth reading is, baby. Page 6. Go ahead.
All right. Long-term New York Magazine restaurant critic Gail Green.
Sure, I know her.
Right? All right. She's just it's just as massive an appetite for sex with larger-than-life levers as she does for gourmet delights.
Why am I not surprised? Why would a gourmet functions with all the same body parts, right?
Yeah, well.
I mean, you got to talk them. It all starts with the golden tongue, right? Go ahead.
All right. In her upcoming memoir, Insatiable Tales from a Life of a Delicious or of Delicious Excess, it's due out in April from Warner Books. The unrepentant hedonist describes steamy nights of passion with Clint Eastwood, porn star Jamie Gillis, and Elvis Presley in between dishing on her favorite haute cuisine meals.
Were they all together?
That's my question. Actually, no. As we get down further into the article, she describes them separately. Now, for me, and I have to agree with her, for me, the two greatest discoveries of the 20th century were the Cuisinart and the clitoris.
She doesn't use them together, does she?
I don't know.
Two chicks in a toaster oven.
I'll go back to the hotel and give that a whirl and let you know if it works.
That'll hurt in the morning.
All right. Among the hotter hookups, she details. You ready for this? And this is just straight out of a novel. Clint Eastwood, she says, he came to my room at the Beverly Wilshire. I opened the door and my knees buckled at the impact of his Clint Eastwood-ness. whatever that may be.
What year did this actually happen? She says, I was a puddle of jello. I forget any questions I needed to ask. I'm not sure we even spoke. Listen to the music.
That's nice.
It never occurred to me that what we had might go on beyond the Beverly Wilshire. It sounds vaguely spiritual, doesn't it?
It does.
I wonder what it'd be like to make love to a food critic. Would she be better?
Does she use food?
Tasty.
Of course.
Well, yeah.
Of course. You know, we read a thing recently, Val, that said that coffee, if the woman wasn't used to drinking coffee, that it served as an excellent aphrodisiac. And I said, well, if you let it cool off and you just spit it on all the important parts of the map, lick it off, you accomplish the exact same thing. Plus, when you're done, you have a half a cup of coffee to share.
There you go.
maybe it's gourmet coffee. Go ahead. Who's Jamie Gillis?
Porn star. And she says, after watching X-rated movies together in a coin-operated booth at a Times Square porn shop, how'd he end up in that position to begin with? They headed off to have sex. She writes, he took off his belt and bound my wrists. Pushed me down into the thick fur of the rug, ripped off my panties.
This sounds completely, what do you call this? This is reworked. Come on, nobody talks like that normally.
Well, and this would scare me, actually. When a guy.
So wait a minute, he reached down into the thick fur of her panties? Did I get...
He was... By thick fur, the thick fur of the rug.
Her panties were like a thick fur rug?
Well, you know what? This could have been back in the 70s when girls were all natural, so we may be talking thick fur.
God makes you just lust for Brazil.
Yeah. So he ties her up. He rips off her panties, which to me is a little bit scary. But he unzipped his jeans. He was naked, as always, underneath. He slapped me slightly with the end of the belt.
The way I put that is I'll be the exact right amount of disrespectful.
There you go. I'll take it.
Have you ever done it with red licorice ropes? If you take like three of them together and then they hold. They have real good tensile strength. Plus, if you've been a bad girl, I can spank you with them.
Uh-huh.
And if you've been a really good girl, then we can eat it together.
Okay.
Absolution.
I'm into black licorice, though. Does that make any difference?
Absolution.
All right, I'll give it a whirl.
Comes in black also.
Let's see. She says, I felt so silly, I started to laugh. After all, I'd begged for this.
Wait a minute. Jamie Gillis was the guy in, was what you call it? The guy who was on the Minnow, SS Minnow, wasn't it? What's the name of that show?
Oh, on
Gilligan's Island. Is that Jamie Gillis?
No. Who was it? He's got a different career, right?
Yeah, well, one we don't know about.
Oh, Bob Denver John Denver.
Bob Denver.
Now, which one has furry panties? I'm lost.
That's that's Gail Green.
I just stuck on the furry panties. She says, I started to laugh. After all, I begged for this. He slapped me again, and I gave in to pleasure.
No, here's the more interesting part. Mm-hmm. Elvis Presley. this is interesting because he's not here to defend himself. And
right.
he goes, I think it was good. I don't remember the essential details. That right there says across the grassy knoll times the book repository, whatever. You go ahead and read this while I think about the time I slept with Lady Di. Go ahead.
You got it. I think it was good. I don't remember the essential details. It was certainly good enough. I know the reality of it was thrilling.
Hold on. I want to think about the time I slept with Jackie O.
All right. Okay. There you go.
No, go ahead and read it. It's equally real.
No, she says, I know the reality of it was very thrilling beyond anything I might have imagined. After they finished, he twitched a shoulder toward the phone. Would you mind calling and ordering me a fried egg sandwich?
Hold on. I think
it's Jackie calling now.
Elvis. No, we're only singing in Spanish today. It's a reference to the past, baby. Go ahead. I don't think she slept with Elvis. Do you?
You know,
how would she come in contact with Elvis? I mean, it's possible. He obviously slept with a variety of people, but I don't think the fried egg sandwich stands to reason. Wouldn't have you ordered peanut butter and bacon?
Or banana. That's what we've heard.
I've had that sandwich before, actually. I've had that on the tour bus. We had Elvis sandwiches. I actually did an Elvis for almost three full days where instead I said that my feet will never touch regular ground, that we would park the tour bus near the hotel and I would have the big guys like Animal bring a luggage cart and I would step from the tour bus onto the luggage cart so that my feet never touched normal rug. And I would be wheeled through the lobby and up to my room, and from the luggage cart I would hop onto the bed where I would stay until it was time for sound check. And for 3 days I managed to do like that.
So those rumors of you being high maintenance weren't true?
I'm higher maintenance than tropical fish. Kidding?
Oh, you know, when someone starts off an article with, I don't remember the essential details, yeah, I got to go with you. Not so sure this happened. Let's see.
How long the sex lasted or even who was on top.
But right.
She doesn't remember, but I never have forgotten the fried egg sandwich. Wow. That's not a great review, is it?
No, it's not. If I were Elvis, I wouldn't be too happy.
If you're in love with somebody and you just finished a moment of conjugal bliss or a reasonable facsimile, what do you say? What do? Or do you just roll over and order something to eat as well? Go ahead.
No, man. I would remember if I was her and kicked it with Elvis. You could never forget that because he's Elvis. You know, you would remember that. Just like my first time kicking it with J-Lo, I'll never forget that. It was only one time, but it's like engraved in my head when she walked through with her jacket off, you know. So that's why I kind of don't believe that. She would remember all the details, and it was Elvis, too. Oh, come on. She would have remembered it. It's all fabrication.
It doesn't say exactly where this took place. I'm wondering how Gail got in with Elvis. This is an interesting thing because she's been an icon for a long time. She's one of the most famous food critics, and she's always linked this up. This sensual capacity to taste food is the same sensual capacity to
taste other things.
Yeah.
All right.
I wonder if she considers any of this fattening. Anyway, page six. We got another cautionary tale here. Penn, long drug history. Chris Penn. He's not baggy, but grieving friends of the talented actor privately suspect that his death was caused by trucks. How many guys were a Sean Penn, Chris Penn fan? Good? He's a great actor.
Just one movie.
Great actor. He's just one of those guys you don't recognize his name. It's more you got to see his face to go, oh, yeah, okay, that guy.
Maybe that's what drove him into a slight case of depression. What movie do you remember him from, Animal? Do you remember?
I don't remember the name of it, but, you know, then I found out that it was him after he had died and they were showing the movies that he was in. So I didn't really know it was him at the time.
He says here that he was quite open about it. That he said, in 1998, I was a drug addict and it was a tough time and I couldn't face my family and I couldn't even face my... You know what? I bet you it's a competitive issue between him and his brother,
well,
Sean.
Well, I was going to say, when you're living and I think Chris a fantastic actor. When you're living under the shadow of Sean Penn, who has actually won an Oscar, you know, and in my opinion, again, Chris a better actor than Sean. Yeah, I'm with you on that.
I'm curious as to what the final issue is here. But when you grow up in the shadow of somebody like that, what was the last movie that he did? I saw him in, Starsky and Hutch? He played Minnelli, one of the cops, you know, in the shower room.
Yep.
Fighting or whatever, but he didn't look like he was in real good shape there. He looked like he was already in a struggle. I'm wondering what his last acting role was. Interesting stuff, huh? I remember when John Candy passed away. Same kind of scenario. And I had walked into my accountant's office back in Beverly Hills at the time. And the fella, Leon, who was an actor, African-American kid, who's an actor in Cool Runnings, which was the Jamaican bobsled team movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he was sitting in the lobby of the accountant's office. At that same time, in that same week's period, Kurt Cobain from Nirvana had passed away, too. The Kurt Cobain one-step easy applied dental program.
Mm.
Simply grasp the trigger housing gently but firmly with your big toe. At any rate, I walked in, and Leon, the actor, was looking very depressed. And I said, I know who you are. You're a great actor. And he goes, yeah, man, I'm a little depressed, man. My main guy just passed away. And I looked at him, and I said, there ain't no black guys in Nirvana.
All right.
He was
I'll give you that one.
He was talking about John Candy, which was the same kind of Chris Farley. These guys combust. They don't die. They blow like a frog on a hot plate. What's up with this?
Again, the self-defeatist thing that we talked about earlier with the rock stars.
They just, you think that's a conscious effort to just blow up?
I think it's a subconscious effort. Mm-hmm.
Until you become like an Orson Welles or something
right.
Well, this is going to be an interesting case. Another cautionary tale. I wonder if there is such a thing as an ex-junkie. What do you think? I don't think so.
No.
I think once you pierce your skin with a tattoo needle,
mm-hmm.
once you pierce your skin with a hypodermic needle, or, geez, unless you can even extend it to S&M. When somebody, you know, once you cut your skin a little bit through somebody else's lash, you will always go back. Something happens in your brain with that cerebral cortex, which is about the size of the top edge of a little girl's last knuckle, last digit on her little finger. It's so small. And once you start to dose it with all those cool endorphins and dopamines and adrenalines and everything, you're always going to want to go back. Have you ever noticed how ex-junkies are covered with tattoos? They're going right back to the source. They're going right back to the root, not the fruit.
Substituting one addiction for the other.
Oh, completely.
Right. And, you know, and me, having never experimented with needles in a drug sense, once I got my first tattoo, of course, I swore I'd never get it. Well, no, my first tattoo, the tattoo. I swore I'd never get it. And I'll be damned if I sat on that table, and it is a pleasurable pain. It's really absolutely fantastic.
Your brain floods with all the
really,
same stuff.
It really is. It really is. And you do entertain the idea, and I have entertained the idea of going and getting another.
You'll think about it again for the rest of your life.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's
mm-hmm.
why I'm asking about these fellas who get caught up in heroin or, you know, anything that involves a hypodermic, because that's a popular way to go these days. And once you're on that trip, I don't think you ever come back completely.
Yeah.
It stays in your mind forever. If you talk, same thing for body piercing. You can't do just one. Remember when it was Lay's potato chips? Bet you can't just eat one?
Yeah.
There is no such thing as one tongue bolt.
I don't think I've seen one person with a body piercing who doesn't have more than one. Right?
Yeah, it always stays in your brain to get that rush again, to get that buzz again.
Yeah.
What do you think, an animal?
No, when I used to like smoke the crack thing, man, like what got me was the smell, man. It smelled so good. Like when I had quit for like 3 years and I got around somebody and they were smoking it and I smelt it and it was just calling me. But I got out of there, man, because I knew if I'd have hung around, it'd have probably got me again. That's really true what you're saying. You just have to like find new friends, get away from it, because if I wouldn't have did that, man, I'd probably be dead already, because the smell what had me. I just loved it, man.
And it kicks that Pavlovian response where your mouth not only waters, but your brain does,
brain,
man.
Like pulsating.
Oh,
man.
Totally. It gets the same thing that runners get. Every time you go into the running section of the sports store, the guy behind the counter looks at you like this and goes, oh, how many miles are you doing? Because he's getting the exact same flood in the brain that these fellas are getting from the dope. Or, you know, you can get the same kind of thing from any kind of moving meditation. Some people use a bicycle to get it. A lot of people are using drugs to get this. That's why methamphetamine is getting to be so popular. Is because it takes even the tiniest amount to get you into that kind of a thinking, feeling thing. And it's becoming popular now because it's not just recreational. What's happening is truck drivers are using it to make the time shifts, you know, workers in the workplace are using
it. I was going to say, it's running rampant in the workforce, without a doubt.
Corporate, night people who have to work overnight, and you're seeing this all over the world now. And it's the same little point in the brain. That's why I ask you, is it possible to reverse this kind of thing? We were talking earlier about some of the musicians, like with Sly and the Family Stone. I don't know that that's ever reversible. Whatever's cooking with Axl, I don't know if that's drug-induced, but I've been work with some band members where it very much is an issue. And I wonder if you can actually come back from that kind of stuff. Has anybody seen a complete reversal? I'm wondering. 866-313-3733. Give me Chris here. Roth Radio, good to go. Go ahead, Chris.
Hey, how are you? Good morning this morning. Just wanted to tell you guys I'm having a great show this morning.
Thank you much.
You're welcome. I was at the... Are you familiar with the New York Improv?
Please share with us. What?
Well, I was at the New York Improv a couple of weeks ago, and I saw, and this was a real treat because, you know, you never would ever think you'd see this, but I saw Richard Pryor's daughter perform on stage.
Oh, I read about that over the air in Page Six, but go ahead and share with everybody who wasn't there.
Well, you know, it was like you were talking before about Chris Penn living in the shadows of his brother, but I just had to make a comment on that, that Richard Pryor is somebody that nobody could really, you know, move into a spotlight with that kind of comedic attitude, you know, and she got up on stage and, you know, she might have been a good actress, but she was trying to be like her father. And that was really tough, to live in that kind of a shadow. And she was on stage for no more than 20 minutes, and she had to get off. And she even admitted that she was having a bad comic skit, and she just got right off the stage.
So are you saying that, well, what are you saying? What's your reflection?
What I'm saying is that, you know, most of these actors that live in shadows of other actors, they have a hard time coming up and becoming somebody of their own, you know, like a Jim Belushi and a John Belushi. And, you know, they wind up going to some type of drug or something to, you know, make themselves feel better. You know, it's really hard. I mean, I don't know anything about it, but I'm just saying that in the entertainment field, I'm going to imagine that it's very hard to live in the...
in the shadow of somebody. Let me ask you this. You think anorexia is a drug?
No, anorexia is not a drug, no. It's a condition of somebody.
Yeah, but why would they do that to themselves unless that makes them feel a certain way?
That's a control issue there, I think.
Well, I think...
So is all drugs.
I mean, I don't know anorexics personally, but I'm just saying that, you know, they have a chemical imbalance. There's something wrong with them, and, you know, they have to have something, you know, help to correct that.
Oh, I don't think it's a chemical imbalance. I think it's a mental issue, and that what happens is, well, hold on. I'm going to go cook something to eat.
David Lee Roth, weekday mornings.
Roth, 6 a.m.
Omarosa. That's a great name. I love saying that. Omarosa.
Just rolls, huh?
It's a great name. I'm wondering which language that is. We have a very special guest calling in on the telephone here. Omarosa Manigault Stallworth. Y'all know her from The Apprentice, which is Don Trump's reality series. And also, she's from the Today Show. She's been on Dr. Phil. She's been on The Tonight Show, etc. She's Fear Factor. And also, one of my favorites, The Surreal Life. She's got a really interesting story here. This is one of the most clever personalities, one of the brightest personalities in all of reality programming. In fact, she's so bright, I'm wondering if it's real or not. I think she's probably got the reins on this. Put her on the air there, Hutch. Omarosa, it's David Lee. Are you with us?
Good morning, and of course it's real.
No. What I'm sharing with you is you seem to be somebody who has the overview. Most of the folks in reality programming are just kind of floating along. It's sort of like people who play chess. They move the piece and wait to see what happens to it. And you strike me as a very, very clever young lady who sees through this, or you wouldn't be teaching a reality TV show. You're teaching a reality TV show. Tell me what that is involved with.
I'm teaching a class on reality TV on how to profit, how to produce, and how to participate properly in reality TV, and I'm doing that for the Learning Annex, so it's pretty fun.
Are you talking about participating as a character within the show, or are you talking about pitching your own show and being more of a producer or a director, Omarosa?
Well, I've done all three. I've actually got two shows that I've pitched and one that's possibly being picked up, so that's outstanding to be able to go from participating to actually seeing a show that you create on air. But I think the important part is sometimes people get selected for these shows, and I'm going to tell you, David, it's like being thrown into a tornado, you know, and it's a whirlwind. And unless you go in with a game plan, then, you know, you look up and your 15 minutes is gone, and you haven't made any money off of it, and you're trying to pick up the pieces of your life, so...
Well, you've certainly made an impression on the culture, and there are a number of archetypes who are involved in reality programming, just as there are archetypes in modern cinema. Clint Eastwood is an archetype, the man who came from nowhere goes home to no one. Jim Carrey is the archetypical clown around type of a comic. How would you describe the archetype that you have perhaps become?
Oh, by far the villain. No question about it. The absolute badass of the show.
Okay, now I hear you smiling through those words, and that's why I ask you, artist to artist, how much of this did you create? Because if you say to me you totally created that role, all the more is your achievement, girl. Go ahead.
Well, the truth of the matter is Americans have an appetite for the naughty person on the show. They want to see, what are they going to do next? What can we expect when you tune in next week? So I knew that, you know, if I were the good girl, the girl next door, then people wouldn't remember my name. But if I stir the pot a little bit and add a little spice to it, then folks would certainly remember my name.
All the more is your achievement. I remember when Puck first showed up on reality series The Real World or whatever it was with MTV, and he had invented his own character and started to conduct his own script within a script. And and then I remember Bill Clinton commenting on feeling Pablo's pain. There was the outraged gay fella, you know, and there are a number of people. But I think you've latched onto something really interesting about our culture, namely that we love to go boo as much or more than we love to go yay. Do you agree with that?
Oh yeah. If you really are the bad girl, the bad boy of a series, you'll have more fans than the good people of a series will have, because people love to have redemption. They want to see somebody kind of evolve. They want to see characters go from bad to good, or you know what I mean. They want to see you as a dynamic character. They don't want to see you as just one flat character.
Tell your mama and your papa, sometimes good guys don't wear white.
Nope.
Anyways, now tell us a little bit about your background, Omarosa. First off, which language is Omarosa? That's an amazing name. Which language is
it? Yoruba name, and it's actually Omarosa Oni, and it means my beautiful child desired.
That's an amazing name. You know, a name is an important thing in show business. How many copies of The Ancient Mariner would they have sold if they called it The Very Old Sailor? Okay.
Now you know, the funny thing is watching Donald Trump within the first couple of weeks of our taping trying to pronounce my name, because it wasn't like any of the other contestants on the show. And so somebody was always whispering in his ear, it's Omarosa, Omarosa. And I was so adamant about them getting my name right, because I knew it was quite difficult. But once you get it, you never forget it.
Oh, and if you pronounce somebody's name, that's the most coolest thing that you can possibly do. Somebody's name is the most important word in the English, any language, to an individual.
Especially have Donald Trump get it right.
Okay.
Absolutely. Is that Val?
Hi, Omarosa.
Hey, Val.
How are you?
You know
well,
what?
Thank you.
So here's what I perceived with the Donald Trump relationship, Omarosa. Tell me if I'm getting this right. You started off, you were working for Don. Then a few weeks later, you were working together. And then Don was working for you. Go ahead.
I've never heard it quite put that way.
Good girl.
I like it.
Tell us a little bit about your background, my dear, because you have a master's degree in media studies. What's involved in that? What exactly is media studies?
I started my undergrad in TV. I wanted to be a weather girl. And then my master's program, I studied ownership because I wanted to own my own radio and television stations. And my doctorate program is really a study of all mass comm. So I've been studying television, radio, and media and its effects on its audiences for a very long time. So I think I was armed with a little more ammunition than most people that go into reality television.
And then you were jettisoned into the Clinton and Gore White House here. You became Deputy Associate Director of Personnel and Presidential Personnel. So how did you make that leap going from media studies to the White House there? This is fascinating.
Well, I was a journalist, and I covered the inauguration, and I covered both Democratic and Republican conventions, and the political bug just bit me. I mean, I think it always was there. I was always very politically active, but it just bit me when I was in Washington. So I entered my master's program, which is here in D.C., and I started to get involved in Democratic politics. And next thing you know, I was a PUE staffer for Gore, and then I worked my way up to, like you said, Deputy Associate Director of Presidential Personnel.
Hold on one sec.
It was the most tumultuous administration, the most controversial administration ever. I mean, we had everything from Travelgate to, you know, the Whitewater scandal to the Monica Lewinsky scandal to, you know, impeachment. I mean, it was
so really, did you get along with everybody there, or was it closer to what we saw on The Apprentice?
Well, you know what? I'll tell you this. I didn't let anybody walk over me, and I made my opinion very clear. Now, that doesn't make you a very popular person in the administration, but I certainly didn't remain, you know, a press secretary for very long. I worked my way up to the top. And sometimes that means that you're going to hurt some people's feelings, and sometimes that means that you're not going to be the most popular person.
Hold on one sec. Are you going to make your way back into politics? You sound like somebody who has a vision.
Well, there are kings and kingmakers. I like being the kingmaker.
Ooh, I like that. Now, how long have you been doing your reality TV course? Where are you teaching this, Omarosa? Where does this take place?
Learning Annex is a national organization, and it's an alternative adult learning educational system where people who don't want to go to college, per se, can take courses. But I've been teaching adult education classes since I left the White House, but you can go to thelearningannex.com to read about the class. It's going to be so much fun because I have some surprise guests that are going to show up to the class. Some of the biggest names in reality are going to pop in and surprise my students.
And what is some of the course instruction? What would be some of the curriculum titles? Is it broken down?
Well, I give some of the keys to being, first of all, selected for a reality show.
How would you do that? If I said to you, Omarosa, I want to go on to a reality TV show, suppose I was not a celeb, nobody knew who I was, what would be your first two or three reflections on something that I should watch?
The first thing I would say is, what is your story? Because everybody on reality television has to have a story. Like, my story was, I came from the projects to the White House. That was my whole story, you know, this rags to riches story of this real strong, tough African-American woman who didn't take any stuff. And there was another guy on my show who was Country Boy Troy. He came from Boise, Idaho, mm-hmm. and, you know, he's trying to be the one. So you have to have a story. So I'd ask you, what is your story?
Oh, you're asking me? The people know my story. It's an open book.
You're a rock star. But I'm saying, if the average person had to come up with, you know, some big catch. And then I would say, what is your character? Meaning, we all know they have the girl next door, they have the bad boy, they have the golden child, they have the country boy, they have the gay guy, you know, they have the angry black woman, you know.
Sure.
I would ask you, which one of those roles would you fit into?
Okay. Do you allow your students to create their own type? Do you allow people to create and invent something right off the bat?
It depends on what show you were applying for. There are some shows where that's allowed, but there are some other shows where they have definite characterizations that they go with, and they keep that formula no matter what. They're not looking for a different persona.
What about American Idol? Do you deal with getting onto that kind of a show? Is that part of your curriculum?
Absolutely, and Simon is a really good friend of mine, but one of the biggest keys to getting on American Idol, first, is talent. And, you know, the second thing is to present yourself well. Most of those folks don't go prepared into their auditions. They show up wearing anything. They look haphazard. And even though they have a great voice, you know, Simon's looking at him like, but what can we do with you? Can you really be a star?
Oh, I got to say, though, now with American Idol, I think we've pretty much run our gamut as far as running through the talent that's available that's out there. I think if you don't have talent, look at the attention that you're getting. Look at William Hung. Look at the attention that you're getting. They've now expanded the pre-tryouts, the pre-show.
Now, I'm going to tell you, that's the funniest part of the show for me.
Isn't it amazing? That's what's working more so than the folks that are actually talented at this point with American Idol.
Nevertheless,
you know, I don't think that there will be many more William Hunts, to be quite frank. I mean, he was just, I think it was timing. and the universe came together for this guy. But I think I would bet more on becoming American Idol than becoming the next William Hung.
Although I'd like to disagree with both of you here just for the sake of being contentious and theatrical here, is that William Hung has more opportunity than most of the top three contestants to take his place, perhaps just let's say in cinema. Don't tell me William Hung doesn't belong in the next three Adam Sandler movies. Don't tell me that there's no room for him being the weatherman in Oklahoma City. Don't tell me that there's no place for him for theater review or something on an L.A. Channel 5 kind of a station or some such. Don't tell me.
No question. I mean, he's opened some of the biggest shows I've attended. He's been the opening act, and this guy's getting paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to perform just like any big rock star would. So you're absolutely right, but I don't know how many more William Hungs will tolerate.
Well, watching the show is a little bit like a NASCAR race. You're not sure if you're there to see the crash or if you're there
absolutely
to see the winner.
There you go.
That's true. Mm, yeah. That's true. Yeah. That's a good point.
Going boo and going yay. What happens after your reality course runs its course? Amorosa, do you have something in mind for coming up that you can share with us?
Well, you know, I continue to work with my government affairs firm here in Washington, and we're gearing up for another presidential election. That's when we make most of our money.
Question.
Fundraising.
Do you have groupies, Omarosa? You got stalkers yet?
You know, I do have a ton of groupies, but I have lovers and haters. I have people who hate me, but they go to everything that I do. They watch everything that I do, and they buy anything that I endorse. So I'd rather have loyal haters than unloyal fans.
If you were a professional wrestler, wouldn't you rather be the bad guy?
Absolutely.
Nothing
absolutely.
But yeah. My very special guest, Omarosa Manigault Stallworth. She's leading a course in reality TV in Los Angeles. You know her from The Surreal Life, from The Apprentice, and now The Roth Radio Show. Omarosa, thanks so much for your time.
And my full schedule is on Omarosa.com. And thank you so much for having me on. You're awesome.
God bless, baby.
Hey, how's the clothing line, Omarosa? I want to know that. Is she still with us? How's the clothing line, sweetheart? Because you did have impeccable style. So
You know, I have affordable business wear for women coming out. And we've been just working the designs. It's hard to put a line together. But I've got 8 of the 12 pieces together. And then we're ready to rock and roll.
We'll find it all on your website.
God bless.
Thank
Omarosa Manigault Stallworth, Roth Radio. Don't go away.
Bye.
David Lee Roth, Mornings.
Roth, 6 a.m.
Roth Radio. It's all going down like water getting thrown out of a bucket truck, baby. I think I missed my chance for being in Page Six just the other day. Here, you want to share the story, Al? We had just finished work here. We were just at the studio. Go ahead. Bring the music down there for us a little bit.
Then we took a little field trip over to Dave's apartment. Now, I'm not very familiar with the city, so God knows where this was. But it was a big Hispanic community, I think.
It's completely Hispanic. Knock it off.
Yeah, completely Hispanic.
We like that.
Mm-hmm. We don't even say Hispanic. We say Boricua.
There you go.
Boricua. Oye.
And sort of the place I wouldn't picture you living, Dave.
That's precisely why I lived there. 2 years ago, I came here to New York City with the idea of going back to school. I was going to become EMT, which I did. I followed my course of study there. And then I was going to complete my aviation training cycles there. And I became a licensed pilot. I call it the university downtown. And there's only a few people living in the building. I live down where all the tenements are, where the fire escapes and everything. So,
yeah, and there's no way that these people that live in the building, when they tell their friends, oh, yeah, David Lee Roth lives in this building, no chance anybody believes.
Yeah, go smoke another one. Yeah.
No chance, because it just is not like a place that I would picture, you know, a rock star living.
I'm an expert at urban camouflage, man. I live right in amongst the people. The true revolutionary works from the inside out. I walk unnoticed amongst the people. That's why I dress the dark and down like I do here. So,
and there was like little furniture also. I found that interesting. Like you keep like a minimal amount of items.
Oh, nothing. It's what the Japanese call a zero-scape. that there's nothing in the place. I have a hardwood floor, and I train 3 and 4 nights a week with the kendo, you know, and the Japanese swordsmanship. And there's really nothing else in there except books and music. That's it. I don't even eat breakfast in there usually.
Yeah, you had, like, even your television that was not on a stand, and your stereo. It was, like, very, like a minimalist.
Like a student, man. Like going back to NYU.
I call it living like a bachelor, actually.
Oh, completely.
Yeah, uh-huh. You're a simple man.
I also didn't see a bed.
Oh, well, there's a bed. What you didn't see was bed covers, because I sleep in a sleeping bag. Oh, yeah. I put it up on the roof. I didn't show you up on the roof. I had the guy put down that cool new AstroTurf that really looks like turf and whatnot, and I put a tent up there. I got a brand new isothermic tent for when I go cross-country skiing as soon as we get some really good snow or whatever. I slept Friday night up there, actually.
And then you have a second apartment as well right next door.
Sure.
But also not extravagant at all.
No, there's nothing in there.
Nothing in there. Like, what do you use that one for?
Well, that was designed to be the offices, okay? I've since moved out of there and over to the water, you know, over on the Hudson side there. But I said, let's keep this because it's the heart and soul of the city. You know, it's way downtown. I call it the land of the blue crew cut and the tongue bolt. Every third person has that. And I'm there on a keeper of the tribal knowledge visa. Anyway, go ahead, share the story.
Yeah, so then we were there. As soon as we arrived at the apartment, one of the people, the Hispanic people living in your apartment building, they had locked a 18-month-old and I think a year-old baby into the home. Like, the babysitter girl left the house, the apartment, and the door shut behind her. So they were calling to you like you were a superhero to save the day.
Well, when we walked up into the building, there were like 6 people sitting on the landing. All the girls were crying. All the guys were pacing around in little circles like Al Pacino, the famous walk to nowhere, little circles. And one of the guys had a cell phone, and he was trying to decide if he was going to pick 911 or whatever.
Yeah, they were going to go to see if the landlord had a key, but instead they called 911, but it wasn't moving fast enough for Dave. So he went outside, and I don't know where he found this gentleman, but this guy got on a ladder, scaled this wall, and ripped the window for the apartment where the 2 babies were stuck in the place. And then the guy just pulled himself up and into the apartment and save the day.
Necesita hablar español. You got to be able to speak Spanish, man. Because what I did is everybody was weeping and crying and praying for the second coming. I said, come on. I said, knock on the door. Keep knocking. Keep the kids distracted. As long as they're scared and crying, they're not going to crawl under the sink and drink bleach or something.
Right.
Those are pickups that I've made before. So everybody's knocking and trying to scare the kids as much as possible through the locked door. And I went next door to the restaurant and ask the guys, you know, the fellas who only speak Spanish. Right. I says, come on, guys, let's get a ladder. Yeah. Let's take care of this or whatever. I completely ruined my opportunity to be in page 6 because originally I said, hey, I've got a climbing rope upstairs. It's in my tent. Why don't we just throw it over the top of the roof here and I'll
rappel down.
Oh, totally. I've got the 8 brake and I've got all my gear and everything. I go climbing routinely. I'm an all year round climber, not just indoor and stuff. And I said, you know, we'll throw the rope over and you can get the camera and this will be a great thing. And the kids were screaming and crying. So I said, come on. So I went and I got the ladder. I held the ladder. And
The ladder wasn't going to reach the window, so Dave got 2 garbage cans that were on the street and put one leg on each ladder.
Holy
on each garbage
hell.
Can.
Man after my own heart.
Yeah, endangering the welfare of everybody on the block.
That would have been fun to have some of your cohorts actually make the call on you after you fell off the ladder.
No.
You did all right, huh?
As soon as the kids were safe, the ladder was retired, and there was nobody remaining to make a statement, lady. I have yet to see the guy who owns the kids. He's so embarrassed. He's downstairs. He doesn't realize he owes me $65 for the irate locksmith who showed up complaining in Spanish.
That's not pretty.
That's right. And the cops showed up complaining in English. But now it's kind of quiet around there, you know. I gotta wonder. Did I blow it? Should we have gone to? Should we have rappelled down and saved the day, or did I do the right thing with the ladder?
No, you did the right thing. I mean, you used your tools, the garbage can, the ladder, the guy that came out of nowhere to help you.
I'm like MacGyver, man.
No one got video of this?
No.
You're kidding me.
This is a standard New York City moment.
Yeah, not only that, but in that neighborhood, no one was even looking at us strangely when we're putting a ladder on garbage can lids.
Climbing into a window.
Yeah.
Good to know. Good to know.
Nobody blinks an eye in that neighborhood.
Good to know.
Everybody just keeps walking. I had another great New York City moment a few summers ago when I was living up on 2nd and 17th. And a couple of the guys were up on the roof having a beer, the superintendent and the main janitor cat. We'll call them Eddie and Joe.
All right.
And Joe was the Puerto Rican janitor guy, you know, and Eddie was the Italian superintendent, whatever. And we were all drinking beers up on the roof. You know, it was a Friday afternoon after work and whatever. And I went downstairs, you know, to go make a phone call. Mm-hmm. And
you don't have a phone in your apartment either?
Sorry?
You don't have a phone in your apartment either?
No, this was a different place.
Okay.
This is a different place.
Okay, I thought he's simple, but that's pretty simple.
Sure.
Okay, go ahead.
And they'd had a couple of beers, and, you know, Joe, the janitor, didn't know that there's a ledge outside the roof and about 3 feet down. Okay? So the superintendent says to the janitor, man, you know, I've had a few beers, and I'm feeling real bad. I'm feeling lonesome. And I'm feeling bad about my job and my wife and my kids and all, just to hell with it, man. And he jumps over the edge of the roof, lands on the ledge. You know, it's a 5 foot wide ledge,
right.
And he's ducked down. The janitor, Joey, the janitor, he's Puerto Rican. He looks, he goes, oh my God, he just killed himself. And they're going to blame me. So he leaves. He doesn't even look over the edge.
No.
He doesn't even look over the edge. He leaves. He goes and runs and gets into the elevator, heads for the floor. Meanwhile, Ray, the superintendent, he's hiding on the ledge, right? Like this, in the fetal position, waiting for the other guy to look over and go, ha, surprise.
Right, right.
The other guy split. He doesn't know that. Across the street is the Hospital for Joint Diseases or whatever. It's a big, popular hospital in New York. And one of the intensive care nurses looks out the window and goes, oh, my God. We got a jumper across the street. So she calls the police,
Lord,
and the fire department and everybody, okay? I'm waiting in the lobby. They all show up, okay? Here comes Joe. He comes out of one of the elevators. Now Ray upstairs, he's realized things are going wrong. He sees cops. He sees ambulances down below. He goes, I wonder what's going on. He leaves the roof. He comes down, all three of us are standing in the lobby while the cops and the police and the fire guys are rushing all the way up to the roof, and the three of us, we went to Scores and had a drink.
No, I didn't see a jumper. No jumper here.
Classic New York stories, and we're going to hear a few classic New York stories from Elizabeth Haight. She's going to be coming in just a little bit here. She writes a column for the New York Post, and I think today's subject is why married men are hot. Hot or not, it's what we got, baby, right here on Roth Radio. Don't go away.
David Lee Roth, mornings.